Well, good afternoon. My name is Pastor Scott, Scott McDermott, and I am so glad that you are here. See, Stephanie, I didn't say morning. That was good. Or I could have just said Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody. We are so glad that you are here on this special day as we celebrate the birth of Jesus, as we celebrate the coming of the Christ child. It's such a special, such a wonderful, such a blessed day, and we're so glad that you are here. We have been in a series. If you haven't been here, it's fine. I'll recap really quickly what we've been talking about over the past 4 weeks. The 4 weeks leading up to Christmas is called Advent. It's a period of waiting. We're waiting for the Christ child to come. And each week we get closer and closer and closer, but there's still that anticipation. There's still that waiting, that longing for the great gift that God is going to give to us. And during that 4 weeks, we've been doing a series called Unexpected. And during that series, we've looked at different biblical characters in the Christ story, in the Christmas story, who were surprised by the coming of the Christ child. For example, a young girl named Mary, who all of a sudden was pregnant. That was surprising. She didn't see that coming. It was unexpected. Or how about her fiancé, whose soon-to-be bride is now with a child that is not his. That would be unexpected. Or the shepherds. They're just minding their own business, watching their sheep. It's a quiet night. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, there's like lights and angels and people singing. And I mean, that would be unexpected, right? And so we've looked at these stories each week. And we've talked about how the coming of Jesus was unexpected. And I think that all of those things are true. It was absolutely unexpected. And I think the reason that it was so unexpected is because it was unlikely. It's unlikely that the Christ child would be born on that night to that family in that place. In fact, the reason I think that nobody saw it born at all, we're going to talk more about that in a minute, but the reason I think that nobody saw it coming, the reason that there weren't crowds all around the manger singing praise songs, is because it was unlikely. Nobody thought it was going to happen. And nobody thought it was going to happen then and there. It was unexpected because it was unlikely. So I want to drive home what I'm talking about when I say unlikely. And I'm a sports fan. I don't know if any of you are sports fans. But in sports terms, we call this a long shot. Somebody that's not supposed to win. Somebody that really everybody discounts because they're terrible. But every once in a while, they win. In sports terms, especially in football, which I like, and the Colts play here in a little bit, so y'all got to leave so I can go watch the Colts. In sports terms, we call this a long shot, right? And the longest long shot in football history was the 1998 St. Louis Rams. The St. Louis Rams no longer exist. Sorry if you're sad about that. Anyway, the St. Louis Rams in 1998 were supposed to be terrible. Because in 1997, they had gone 4-12 under the leadership of quarterback Tony Banks. If you've never heard of Tony Banks, it's because he wasn't very good. They decided to make a change and promote their quarterback's coach, named Mike Marks, to offensive coordinator. But before he was willing to take the promotion, he insisted that they had to get rid of Tony Banks, which they did. So they went ahead and got Trent Green and Marshall Faulk, and drafted Torrey Holt. You'll notice in the picture that Marshall Faulk is standing in his Hall of Fame jacket. Maybe we should have kept him in Indianapolis, just a thought. Nonetheless, they upgraded at all these positions. Trent Green, of course, played for IU, so he has to be awesome. And they were going to be good until, in the preseason, Trent Green hurt his knee and was out for the year. So now they don't have Tony Banks and they don't have Trent Green. Instead, they have Kurt Warner, who no one had heard of ever because he had recently played in the Arena League and actually most recently had been bagging groceries at his local grocery store for $5.15 an hour. This was the quarterback of the 1998 St. Louis Rams at the beginning of the season. Nobody thought they would win a game, but they did. In fact, they went 13-3 that season. And they started what became known as the greatest show on turf. Sports Illustrated cleverly asked, who is this guy? Because no one knew who he was. The Rams went from nothing to flaming hot. They couldn't lose. And improbably, they even went to and won the Super Bowl that year, 23-16 over the Tennessee Titans. And maybe memorably, most memorably, on the final play of the game, Tennessee had the ball, threw a pass, and the guy was tackled on the 1 yard line, giving the St. Louis Rams the victory. Now, the odds in Vegas, and I'm not a gambling man, but the odds in Vegas were 300-1. If you had placed a single dollar bet on the St. Louis Rams at the beginning of the season, you would have won $300 at the end. That's a long shot. They were not supposed to win, but they did. Statistically, they shouldn't have, but they did. That's what we call a long shot. But that's not the longest long shot of all. So we're going to talk about how the fact that Jesus being the Messiah is unlikely. Jesus is the longest long shot of all. So I want to look at some statistics. Now, some of you are going to laugh because you know I'm terrible at math. Okay? I did a lot of work on this, people. So hopefully I didn't get it wrong. If I did, I'm really, really sorry. In the Old Testament, which the bulk of the Bible is, there are over 300 prophecies regarding the coming of the Messiah. Many of those prophecies are very specific and could not accidentally be achieved, could not be faked. Those are very specific prophecies in the Old Testament about the coming of the Messiah. Now, there was a professor named Peter Stoner who was at Westmont College. He was a Christian man, and he wanted to understand how unlikely it was that one person could fulfill some of the prophecies of the Old Testament. So he got his class of about 600 students to work on some probabilities regarding the likelihood that one person could fulfill the prophecies of the Old Testament. He worked on this and finally submitted his findings to the American Scientific Affiliation, which, upon examination, verified that they were dependable and accurate. So what were his findings? Well, he started with one prophecy, Micah 5:2. Micah 5:2 tells us that the Messiah would be born in the town of Bethlehem, which is, in fact, little. It is a little town of Bethlehem. Okay, so the Messiah would be born in the town of Bethlehem, and he discovered, based on the population of Bethlehem and the population of the earth, that there was a 1 in 300,000 chance of a person fulfilling just that one prophecy. Just one. I told you there's over 300 in the Old Testament regarding the Messiah. So 1 in 300,000 would be able to fulfill that prophecy. He then decided to up the ante and look at how many prophecies could he predict that were likely. So he looked at 8 specific prophecies from the Old Testament, and he again ran the math. What are the odds that someone could fulfill 8 of the Old Testament prophecies? This is where it gets crazy. The odds are 10 to the 17th power, or that number right there, which is a lot of zeros, people, right? Now, I know that this is a hard number to understand. It's much bigger than my bank account. So in order to fully understand how big that number is, Peter Stoner gave us an analogy, and this is the analogy. If you took that many coins and you covered the state of Texas with that many coins, that would be covered 2 feet deep. So knee-high in coins covering the entire state of Texas, which is very large. That's a lot of coins. Let's say you marked one of those coins with a special marking, and then you sent a blindfolded man into the state of Texas, which would be weird because it's covered with coins. So maybe he has like a hoverboard. I don't know how it works, okay? But he goes blindfolded, which is probably dangerous riding a hoverboard, and then he picks one coin. And if he picks the one marked coin out of all those coins, that is the same probability as one person fulfilling 8 of the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. That's pretty staggering, right? And that's only 8 prophecies. As I told you, there are over 300 prophecies about the Messiah. This is a pretty long, long shot. And as a result of the fact that it's very hard for anyone to fulfill even a few of the prophecies, let alone all 300, the result was that the people of Israel, who knew these prophecies, who had been taught these prophecies, they waited. Yes. And they waited for a very long time. You might remember the great poet Tom Petty telling us, the waiting is the hardest part. And he's right. The waiting is the hardest part. And the people of Israel had waited a very long time. Kids, I got kids in the room. You've been waiting. You've been waiting for tomorrow for a long time. Do you remember like 3 weeks ago when you made a list of what you wanted for Christmas? And then you wrote a letter to Santa? And then you have to wait. It's terrible. Right? And every day you get up and you ask, is it Christmas? And every day your parents say, no. And then it's like sad and depressing, right? That's how you feel. But I got good news, kids. I got good news. Tomorrow is the day. Tomorrow you will wake up in the morning and there will be presents unless you were bad. And then you'll get coal. Now, tomorrow is the day. The waiting is over. But for the people of Israel, they had not been waiting for a few weeks. They had not been waiting for a little while. They had been waiting for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. See, when the Old Testament was written, they didn't know when the Messiah would come. They knew a little bit about the Messiah, and they knew that he would come, but they didn't know when. And so they just had to wait. So I want to look at a couple, just a few of these prophecies. And I want to tell you how long the people had to wait for these prophecies to be fulfilled by Jesus. In Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, it says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel. So they knew the miracle of the virgin birth was going to happen. They just didn't know when. Turned out, it was going to be 700 years later. From the time Isaiah wrote those words to the time that Jesus was born, about 700 years. That's a long time to wait. Or how about this one? In the book of Genesis, chapter 49, it says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. Now that tells us specifically that the Messiah will need to be born from the tribe of Judah. There are 12 families in the people of Israel, 12 tribes. He needs to come from the tribe of Judah, not any of the other tribes. So it's not enough just to be Jewish. You have to be from the tribe of Judah. Well, that prophecy was written about 2,000 years before the birth of Jesus. Or this last one that we already looked at from Micah 5:2. It says, you, Bethlehem Ephrath, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. This one, almost 3,000 years. That is a long time to wait. And waiting is hard. Tom Petty already told us, and this cat reminds us. Right? Waiting is hard. It makes us sad. We don't like it. We don't want to wait. We don't want to wait for things. And here's what happens when you wait for a really long time for something. When you wait for a really long time for something, you start to imagine that it's coming true. You start to see things that aren't really there. It's the mirage effect, right? The guy in the desert looking for water, all of a sudden he sees this oasis and he gets there and it's just more sand. You're starting to see things that don't really exist. And when you're waiting for something for that long, for almost 3,000 years, you start to look for any small sign that what you're waiting for has come true. And so over the centuries, what happened to the people of Israel is there would be a person here or there that maybe met a few of the prophecies. And so they would get really excited and they would jump to the conclusion, the Messiah has come. But it didn't ever work out. For example, Zerubbabel, not a particularly popular biblical character, but Zerubbabel was the person during the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. He took on the project of rebuilding the temple. Right? And he became so popular because they now had a temple again. They had a place to worship God again. They had been waiting for so long. When Zerubbabel came and started rebuilding the temple, they thought, maybe he's the one. But Zerubbabel died, and he didn't come back to life. And that was pretty much the end of Zerubbabel's messianic claim. Or how about Judas Maccabeus? This is one of my favorite Old Testament or, you know, between the Testament characters. Judas Maccabeus is a famous warrior. He started a revolution that for a brief period of time gave Israel their freedom once again. He was so popular and so ferocious in battle that he earned a nickname. Maccabeus means the hammer. How cool is that, right? If you're a warrior, it doesn't get much better than the hammer. Hi, I'm Judas. Judas the hammer, right? Like, that's so cool. Anyway, so Judas Maccabeus led this revolution. They got rid of the Seleucid Empire. They were free. But then he was killed in battle. And again, that was pretty much the end of Judas the hammer. But for a brief period of time, the people would get their hopes up. They would start to see little signs here and there pointing them to people who maybe were the Messiah. But nobody was looking when Jesus was born. Nobody was excited at the coming of this child. They were excited about Zerubbabel. They were excited about Judas. But nobody was excited about Jesus. And I'll tell you why. There are a few reasons why nobody thought that Jesus was the Messiah. First, he was born in a lowly place. Bethlehem and the whole region that Bethlehem is in, and the region where Jesus grew up, they were like looked down upon. They were the backwater, backwoods, hillbilly. Everybody made fun of them in that region of the world, in that region of Israel. Even other Jewish people made fun of people from that region of Israel. It was a lowly place. Not to mention that he's born in a manger. It was lowly. Or how about this? He was born to the wrong parents. His parents weren't wealthy. They weren't educated. They weren't famous. They were simple working class people. His mom got pregnant out of wedlock. These were the wrong parents. If you want to be the Messiah, nobody's getting excited about this family. Or the fact that he almost died before he ever got to be the Messiah. He almost died as a child. So I want to look at each of these reasons, and I want to tell you that this is part of the reason that nobody thought Jesus was going to be the Messiah. So first, he was born in a lowly place. In chapter 1 of John, there's a conversation between two brothers who are going to become disciples of Jesus, Philip and Nathanael. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth." Well, Nathanael's response is less than exciting. He says, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" Yeah, he's not impressed. He does not believe that Jesus is the Messiah until he meets Jesus. But the fact that Jesus is from Nazareth, he almost discounts him offhand. Or again, in John chapter 7, some people mock Jesus and say, "How can the Messiah come from Galilee?" They don't believe that the Messiah can come from this backwater, backwoods, hillbilly area. And so they discount Jesus almost immediately. And then there's the fact that his family is less than impressive. In Matthew 13, it says, "Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? And aren't his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas?" They immediately discount Jesus because his dad is a carpenter. And I've met his family. They're not that impressive. So they discount Jesus because of what his family background is. And then there's the fact that Jesus barely made it through his childhood. I don't know if you know the story that is known as the murder of the innocents, but there's a story in Matthew chapter 2 that is heartbreaking in its scope of tragedy. It says this: "An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. 'Get up,' he said. 'Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child and kill him.' So he," Joseph, "got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I call my son,'" which, by the way, is another of the Old Testament messianic prophecies. Then it says in verse 16, and this is where it's heartbreaking, "When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity, who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi." Hundreds of babies were killed. Hundreds of little boys were killed during what must have been a terrible, terrible day. Children ripped from the arms of their mothers and slaughtered because Herod was so power hungry that he was willing to kill innocent children to keep his kingdom. Sadly, This kind of violence continues to happen all over the world, including right now in Aleppo. I found this picture, which reminded me a lot of the picture I put up earlier, of a mother shielding her children from the violence that's happening right now. We live in a very broken world. It was broken 2,000 years ago, and it's still broken. So Jesus was unlikely to be the Messiah because he barely lived. Jesus was unlikely to be the Messiah because he was from the wrong place. He was from the wrong family. Nobody came to the manger to worship him except for the shepherds who were tipped off by the angels. Nobody else even showed up. Nobody was expecting Jesus. Nobody was expecting the Messiah. They'd given up. They'd been waiting too long. They were jaded and they didn't care. They didn't believe that the Messiah was really coming. Or maybe they just didn't believe he would come then or there or to that family in that place. But no one was expecting Jesus because he was unlikely. But Jesus is the Messiah. He meets all 300 plus of those prophecies, the odds of which are astronomical. But he is the Messiah. And it really shouldn't surprise us because God is in the business of doing unlikely things. From choosing Moses, who was a known murderer, to choosing the disciples who were less than impressive, God regularly does unlikely things. My message for you today on Christmas is this. Jesus was an unlikely Messiah. You may be wondering if God could ever use you. Maybe you think you've done too many bad things. Maybe you think that you haven't been good enough, that you're somehow on God's naughty list. But you're not. God does unlikely things all the time. Maybe you think it's unlikely that God would use you, that God would choose you, that God would want you. I often think it's unlikely that I would be here doing what I'm doing. But here I am. And it's not because I'm good or better. It's because I said yes, which is all you have to do. God loves to do unlikely things because it shows who he is. It shows his power. When he uses us, the least likely, the least impressive, flawed and failed, sinful and broken, it shows his glory and his power to take the small light that we have when he made us in his image and let it grow. Let it light the world. It gives him glory. So you may think it's unlikely that God would use you, but I don't think so. I think it totally makes sense. I think it's who God is. I think it's very likely that God is calling you, that God wants you, that God will use you. I think it's very likely that God could use you to do great things. So here in a minute, I'm going to give you that opportunity to symbolically hold up your candle, to offer yourself to God, to raise your hand and say, God, I don't have much, but I'll let my light shine. And then together, as we all raise our candles to the sky, to see what we could do together, to see how the light of Christ in us and through us can light this room, and to realize maybe, just maybe, God is willing to use you to light the whole world, to take all of us, not just in this room, but in every church, in every country, in the world today. Today, all Christians around the globe gather to worship Jesus and to say that we will hold up our candles, that we will give our light to Christ. And it may seem unlikely, but I don't think God thinks so. I think today he wants us all to be willing to be used by him. So let's let our light shine.